Here we have, first of all, an unmistakable attack made by the youthful Socrates on the paradoxes of Zeno. He perfectly understands their drift, and Zeno himself is supposed to admit this. But they appear to him, as he says in the Philebus also, to be rather truisms than paradoxes. For everyone must acknowledge the obvious fact, that the body being one has many members, and that, in a thousand ways, the like partakes of the unlike, the many of the one. The real difficulty begins with the relations of ideas in themselves, whether of the one and many, or of any other ideas, to one another, and to the mind. But this was a problem which the elitic philosophers had never considered. Their thoughts had not gone beyond the contradictions of matter, motion, space, and the like. It was no wonder that Parmenides and Zeno should hear the novel speculations of Socrates with mixed feelings of admiration and displeasure. He was going out of the received circle of disputation into a region in which they could hardly follow him. From the crude idea of being in the abstract, he was about to proceed to universals or general notions. There is no contradiction in material things partaking of the ideas of one and many. Neither is there any contradiction in the ideas of one and many, like and unlike, in themselves. But the contradiction arises when we attempt to conceive ideas in their connection, or to ascertain their relation to phenomena. Still he affirms the existence of such ideas, and this is the position which is now in turn submitted to the criticisms of Parmenides. To appreciate truly the character of these criticisms, we must remember the place held by Parmenides in the history of Greek philosophy. He is the founder of idealism, and also of dialectic, or, in modern phraseology, of metaphysics and logic. Like Plato, he is struggling after something wider and deeper than satisfied the contemporary Pythagoreans. And Plato, with a true instinct, recognizes him as his spiritual father, whom he revered and honored more than all other philosophers together. He may be supposed to have thought more than he said, or was able to express. And, although he could not, as a matter of fact, have criticized the ideas of Plato without an anachronism, the criticism is appropriately placed in the mouth of the founder of the ideal philosophy. There was probably a time in the life of Plato, when the ethical teaching of Socrates came into conflict with the metaphysical theories of the earlier philosophers, and he sought to supplement the one by the other. The older philosophers were great and awful, and they had the charm of antiquity. Something which found a response in his own mind seemed to have been lost as well as gained in the Socratic dialectic. He felt no incongruity in the veteran Parmenides correcting the youthful Socrates. Two points in his criticism are especially deserving of notice. First of all, Parmenides tries him by the test of consistency. Socrates is willing to assume ideas or principles of the just, the beautiful, the good, and to extend them to man. But he is reluctant to admit that there are general ideas of hair, mud, filth, etc. There is an ethical universal or idea, but is there also a universal of physics, of the meanest things in the world as well as of the greatest? Parmenides rebukes this want of consistency in Socrates, which he attributes to his youth. As he grows older, philosophy will take a firmer hold of him, and then he will despise neither great things nor small, and he will think less of the opinions of mankind. Here is lightly touched one of the most familiar principles of modern philosophy, that in the meanest operations of nature, as well as in the noblest, in mud and filth, as well as in the sun and stars, great truths are contained. At the same time, we may note also the transition in the mind of Plato, to which Aristotle alludes, when, as he says, he transferred the Socratic universal of ethics to the whole of nature. The other criticism of Parmenides on Socrates attributes to him a want of practice in dialectic. He has observed this deficiency in him when talking to Aristotle's on a previous occasion. Plato seems to imply that there was something more in the dialectic of Zeno than in the mere interrogation of Socrates. Here, again, he may perhaps be describing the process which his own mind went through when he first became more intimately acquainted, whether at Megara or elsewhere, with the Elitic and Megarian philosophers. Still, Parmenides does not deny to Socrates the credit of having gone beyond them, in seeking to apply the paradoxes of Zeno to ideas, and this is the application which he himself makes of them in the latter part of the dialogue. He then proceeds to explain to him the sort of mental gymnastic which he should practice. He should consider not only what would follow from a given hypothesis, but what would follow from the denial of it, to that which is the subject of the hypothesis, and to all other things. There is no trace in the memorabilia of Xenophon of any such method being attributed to Socrates, nor is the dialectic here spoken of that favorite method of proceeding by regular divisions, which is described in the Phaedrus and Philebus, and of which examples are given in the Politicus and in the Sophist. It is expressly spoken of as the method which Socrates had heard Zeno practice in the days of his youth. The discussion of Socrates with Parmenides is one of the most remarkable passages in Plato. Few writers have ever been able to anticipate the criticism of the morrow on their own favorite notions. But Plato may here be said to anticipate the judgment, not only of the morrow, but of all after ages on the Platonic ideas. For in some points he touches questions which have not yet received their solution in modern philosophy. The first difficulty which Parmenides raises respecting the Platonic ideas relates to the manner in which individuals are connected with them. Do they participate in the ideas, or do they merely resemble them? Parmenides shows that objections may be urged against either of these modes of conceiving the connection. Things are little by partaking of littleness, great by partaking of greatness, and the like. But they cannot partake of a part of greatness, for that will not make them great, etc., nor can each object monopolize the whole. The only answer to this is that partaking is a figure of speech, really corresponding to the processes which a later logic designates by the terms abstraction and generalization. When we have described accurately the methods or forms which the mind employs, we cannot further criticize them, at least we can only criticize them with reference to their fitness as instruments of thought to express facts. Socrates attempts to support his view of the ideas by the parallel of the day, which is one, and in many places, but he is easily driven from his position by a counter-illustration of Parmenides, who compares the idea of greatness to a sail. He truly explains to Socrates that he has attained the conception of ideas by a process of generalization. At the same time, he points out a difficulty which appears to be involved, viz., that the process of generalization will go on to infinity. Socrates meets the supposed difficulty by a flash of light, which is indeed the true answer, that the ideas are in our minds only. Neither realism is the truth, nor nominalism is the truth, but conceptualism. And conceptualism or any other psychological theory falls very far short of the infinite subtlety of language and thought. But the realism of ancient philosophy will not admit of this answer, which is repelled by Parmenides with another truth or half-truth of later philosophy: every subject or subjective must have an object. Here is the great though unconscious truth, shall we say, or error, which underlay the early Greek philosophy. Ideas must have real existence. They are not mere forms or opinions, which may be changed arbitrarily by individuals. But the early Greek philosopher never clearly saw that true ideas were only universal facts, and that there might be error in universals as well as in particulars. Socrates makes one more attempt to defend the Platonic ideas by representing them as paradigms. This is again answered by the argumentum ad infinitum. We may remark, in passing, that the process which is thus described has no real existence. The mind, after having obtained a general idea, does not really go on to form another which includes that and all the individuals contained under it, and another without end. The difficulty belongs in fact to the Megarian age of philosophy, and is due to their illogical logic, and to the general ignorance of the ancients respecting the part played by language in the process of thought. No such perplexity could ever trouble a modern metaphysician, any more than the fallacy of calves or asavus, or of Achilles in the tortoise, these surds of metaphysics ought to occasion no more difficulty in speculation than a perpetually recurring fraction in arithmetic. It is otherwise with the objection which follows: how are we to bridge the chasm between human truth and absolute truth, between gods and men? This is the difficulty of philosophy in all ages. How can we get beyond the circle of our own ideas, or how, remaining within them, can we have any criterion of a truth beyond and independent of them? Parmenides draws out this difficulty with great clearness. According to him, there are not only one but two chasms. The first, between individuals and the ideas which have a common name. The second, between the ideas in us, and the ideas absolute. The first of these two difficulties mankind, as we may say, a little parodying the language of the Philebus, have long agreed to treat as obsolete. The second remains a difficulty for us as well as for the Greeks of the 4th century before Christ, and is the stumbling block of Kant's critic, and of the Hamiltonian adaptation of Kant, as well as of the Platonic ideas. It has been said that you cannot criticize revelation. Then how do you know what is revelation, or that there is one at all, is the immediate rejoinder. You know nothing of things in themselves. Then how do you know that there are things in themselves? In some respects, the difficulty pressed harder upon the Greek than upon ourselves. For conceiving of God more under the attribute of knowledge than we do, he was more under the necessity of separating the divine from the human, as two spheres which had no communication with one another. It is remarkable that Plato, speaking by the mouth of Parmenides, does not treat even this second class of difficulties as hopeless or insoluble. He says only that they cannot be explained without a long and laborious demonstration. The teacher will require superhuman ability, and the learner will be hard of understanding. But an attempt must be made to find an answer to them. For, as Socrates and Parmenides both admit, the denial of abstract ideas is the destruction of the mind. We can easily imagine that among the Greek schools of philosophy in the 4th century before Christ a panic might arise from the denial of universals, similar to that which arose in the last century from Hume's denial of our ideas of cause and effect. Men do not at first recognize that thought, like digestion, will go on much the same, notwithstanding any theories which may be entertained respecting the nature of the process. Parmenides attributes the difficulties in which Socrates is involved to a want of comprehensiveness in its mode of reasoning. He should consider every question on the negative as well as the positive hypothesis, with reference to the consequences which flow from the denial as well as from the assertion of a given statement. The argument which follows is the most singular in Plato. It appears to be an imitation, or parody, of the Zenonian dialectic, just as the speeches in the Phaedrus are an imitation of the style of Lysias, or as the derivations in the Cratylus, or the fallacies of the Euthydemus, are a parody of some contemporary sophist. The interlocutor is not supposed, as in most of the other Platonic dialogues, to take a living part in the argument. He is only required to say yes and no in the right places. A hint has been already given that the paradoxes of Zeno admitted of a higher application. This hint is the thread by which Plato connects the two parts of the dialogue. The paradoxes of Parmenides seem trivial to us, because the words to which they relate have become trivial. Their true nature as abstract terms is perfectly understood by us, and we are inclined to regard the treatment of them in Plato as a mere straw-splitting, or legerdemain of words. Yet there was a power in them which fascinated the Neoplatonists for centuries afterwards. Something that they found in them, or brought to them, some echo or anticipation of a great truth or error, exercised a wonderful influence over their minds. To do the Parmenides justice, we should imagine similar Crippen raised on themes as sacred to us as the notions of one, or being were to an ancient Eleatic. If God is, what follows? If God is not, what follows? Or again, if God is or is not the world, or if God is or is not many, or has not parts, or is not in the world, or in time, or is not finite or infinite, or if the world is or is not, or has a beginning or end, or is not infinite, or infinitely divisible. Or again, if God is or is not identical with his laws, or if man is or is not identical with the laws of nature. We can easily see that here are many subjects for thought, and that from these and similar hypotheses questions of great interest might arise. And we also remark that the conclusions derived from either of the two alternative propositions might be equally impossible and contradictory. When we ask what is the object of these paradoxes, some have answered that they are a mere logical puzzle, while others have seen in them an Hegelian propedeutic of the doctrine of ideas. The first of these views derives support from the manner in which Parmenides speaks of a similar method being applied to all ideas. Yet it is hard to suppose that Plato would have furnished so elaborate an example, not of his own, but of the elitic dialectic, had he intended only to give an illustration of method. The second view has been often overstated by those who, like Hegel himself, have tended to confuse ancient with modern philosophy. We need not deny that Plato, trained in the school of Cratylus and Heraclitus, may have seen that a contradiction in terms is sometimes the best expression of a truth higher than either. But his ideal theory is not based on antinomies. The correlation of ideas was the metaphysical difficulty of the age in which he lived, and the Megarian and Cynic philosophy was a reductio ad absurdum of their isolation. To restore them to their natural connection, and to detect the negative element in them is the aim of Plato in the Sophist. But his view of their connection falls very far short of the Hegelian identity of being and not being. The being and not being of Plato never merge in each other, though he is aware that determination is only negation. After criticizing the hypotheses of others, it may appear presumptuous to add another guess to the many which have been already offered. May we say, in Platonic language, that we still seem to see vestiges of a track which has not yet been taken? It is quite possible that the obscurity of the Parmenides would not have existed to a contemporary student of philosophy, and, like the similar difficulty in the Philebus, is really due to our ignorance of the mind of the age. There is an obscure Megarian influence on Plato which cannot wholly be cleared up, and is not much illustrated by the doubtful tradition of his retirement to Megara after the death of Socrates. For Megara was within a walk of Athens, and Plato might have learned the Megarian doctrines without settling there. We may begin by remarking that the theses of Parmenides are expressly said to follow the method of Zeno, and that the complex dilemma, though declared to be capable of universal application, is applied in this instance to Zeno's familiar question of the one and many. Here, then, is a double indication of the connection of the Parmenides with the Aristotelic school. The old elitics had asserted the existence of being, which they at first regarded as finite, then as infinite, then as neither finite nor infinite, to which some of them had given what Aristotle calls a form, others had ascribed a material nature only. The tendency of their philosophy was to deny to being all predicates. The Megarians, who succeeded them, like the Cynics, affirmed that no predicate could be asserted of any subject. They also converted the idea of being into an abstraction of good, perhaps with the view of preserving a sort of neutrality or indifference between the mind and things. As if they had said, in the language of modern philosophy, being is not only neither finite nor infinite, neither at rest nor in motion, but neither subjective nor objective. This is the track along which Plato is leading us. Zeno had attempted to prove the existence of the one by disproving the existence of the many, and Parmenides seems to aim at proving the existence of the subject by showing the contradictions which follow from the assertion of any predicates. Take the simplest of all notions, unity. You cannot even assert being or time of this without involving a contradiction. But is the contradiction also the final conclusion? Probably no more than of Zeno's denial of the many, or of Parmenides' assault upon the ideas, no more than of the earlier dialogues of such. To us there seems to be no residuum of this long piece of dialectics. But to the mind of Parmenides and Plato, got Bertram Keene mention, there still remained the idea of being or good, which could not be conceived, defined, uttered, but could not be got rid of. Neither of them would have imagined that their disputation ever touched the divine being. The same difficulties about unity and being are raised in this office, but they're only as preliminary to their final solution. If this view is correct, the real aim of the hypothesis of Parmenides is to criticize the earlier elitic philosophy from the point of view of Zeno or the Megarians. It is the same kind of criticism which Plato has extended to his own doctrine of ideas. Nor is there any want of poetical consistency in attributing to the Father Parmenides the last review of the elitic doctrines. The latest phases of all philosophies were fathered upon the founder of the school. Other critics have regarded the final conclusion of the Parmenides either as skeptical or as Heraclitian. In the first case, they assume that Plato means to show the impossibility of any truth. But this is not the spirit of Plato, and could not with propriety be put into the mouth of Parmenides, who, in this very dialogue, is urging Socrates not to doubt everything, but to discipline his mind with a view to the more precise attainment of truth. The same remark applies to the second of the two theories. Plato everywhere ridicules, perhaps unfairly, his Heracleitean contemporaries, and if he had intended to support an Heracleitean thesis, would hardly have chosen Parmenides, the condemner of the undiscerning tribe who say that things both are and are not, to be the speaker. Nor, thirdly, can we easily persuade ourselves with Zeller that by the one he means the idea, and that he is seeking to prove indirectly the unity of the idea in the multiplicity of phenomena. We may now endeavor to thread the mazes of the labyrinth which Parmenides knew so well, and trembled at the thought of them. The argument has two divisions. There is the hypothesis that 1. One is. 2. One is not. If one is, it is nothing. If one is not, it is everything. But is and is not may be taken in two senses. Either one is one, or one has being, from which opposite consequences are deduced. 1. A. If one is one, it is nothing. 1. B. If one has being, it is all things, to which are appended two subordinate consequences. 1. R. If one has being, all other things are. 1. BB. If one is one, all other things are not. The same distinction is then applied to the negative hypothesis. 2. A. If one is not one, it is all things. 2. B. If one has not being, it is nothing. Involving two parallel consequences respecting the other or remainder. 2. R. If one is not one, other things are all. 2. BB. If one has not being, other things are not. I cannot refuse, said Parmenides, since, as Zeno remarks, we are alone, though I may say with Ibicus, who in his old age fell in love, I, like the old racehorse, tremble at the prospect of the course which I am to run, and which I know so well. But as I must attempt this laborious game, what shall be the subject? Suppose I take my own hypothesis of the one. By all means, said Zeno. And who will answer me? Shall I propose the youngest? He will be the most likely to say what he thinks, and his answers will give me time to breathe. I am the youngest, said Aristoteles, and at your service. Proceed with your questions. The result may be summed up as follows.